Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, May 26, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read Points of Progress, and hey, Science and Nature is back again, so I'll read that. The Home Forum, and then the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, When Courage Meets Candor. This is written by Ken Macon, who is a cultural commentator. And it says, you can email us at editor@csmonitor.com. And he writes, stepping foot on Claflin University's campus in Orangeburg, South Carolina, is walking onto Freeland, the name that was given to the campus during the civil rights movement. It is a legacy that endures and that I experienced in Minister's Hall at Claflin when I sat with some of the elders from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or the SNCC. Their presence inspired me because I knew what they had done as teenagers through the sit-in movement and how it changed the world. I had barely settled into my seat when civil rights activist Judy Richardson began to read a startling statement. She and others had learned that the grant funding for the lecture series SNCC and Grassroots Organizing had been terminated, the result of cuts to the National Endowment for the Humanities. The move was tied to broader belt tightening by the Trump administration, but it also came amid a societal shift away from diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts that many have seen as the natural extension of the civil rights battles waged in the 1960s. Nevertheless, Ms. Richardson and the group did what they've done for the last 65 years. They pushed ahead with a steely determination and love in their hearts. Over those next few hours, I sat with the elders and learned about SNCC, from their efforts to build political power to the care and concern they expressed for people who had been harmed by racism and classism. Their defiance was different from the despair that I had seen in recent months due to the current administration and was a compelling reminder of what is birthed when courage meets candor. What also jumped out to me was how youthful the elders looked. Ms. Richardson, reportedly 81 years old, is still vibrant and full of songs with palpable energy. Books might say she was the former field secretary for SNCC, but those who are familiar with the work know she is a forever field secretary. My dear Aunt Joyce has a line that she recites often, wherever you go, represent. These SNCC members represent timeless dedication to righteousness, the resolve to stare down death and choose life. Some of those deaths were the result of government neglect, others the result of Jim Crow, under the umbrella of a nation that Martin Luther King Jr. said was approaching spiritual death. Where Dr. King is with us in spirit, the elders remain, forever young and marked by those experiences. That history, and more importantly, honesty, can help us cut through the divisive rhetoric of the present time. There are some who see the removal of social safety nets, murals, and much more as the end of a progressive era. I am reminded of a familiar refrain from SNCC, those who believe in freedom cannot rest. America has largely been out of tune regarding that refrain, but its greatest defenders of democracy and its tillers for a better world have not. In our cover story this week, Story Hinckley introduces readers to some of these modern tillers, individuals who were moved by the injustice of George Floyd's murder to strive for change. Momentum has been difficult to sustain, but as one source tells Story, even though there has been a swing back, there are still people pushing forward. And that was the From the Editor column this week written by Ken Macon, who is a cultural commentator, and it was entitled When Courage Meets Candor. And that does lead us into the cover story. This week it's entitled 5 Years Later, George Floyd's murder prompted Americans to re-examine their communities and themselves. What happened to that momentum? Residents on Troost Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri, still confront a wall of racial separation, And despite drawbacks, they haven't given up on progress. This is written by Story Hinckley, who's a staff writer. And they do have this paragraph here entitled Why We Wrote This. It's got a heading of Community. Metropolitan Kansas City remains one of the most segregated places in the U.S. 5 years after George Floyd's death, how much has changed? From Kansas City, Missouri and Prairie Village, Kansas, you can see it on a map, but if you're driving, you might not know it's the border between Missouri and Kansas. State Line Road, a major thoroughfare, runs north-south through Greater Kansas City. Drive northbound, and you're in Missouri. Drive southbound, and you're in Kansas. On both sides, affluence abounds. Sharpened hedges dot lawns and fountains cascade in the road's roundabouts. The Missouri side has two of the area's top private schools. The Kansas side has several country clubs with five-figure initiation fees. Now drive 2 miles east from State Line Road to Troost Avenue. Here you will find Greater Kansas City's real dividing line. Known locally as the Troost Wall, the differences on either side are impossible to miss. Color-coded census maps of the neighborhood look like someone took a marker and drew a strict social border, a border that separates two different realities. East of Troost, neighborhoods are almost 90% black, with average incomes between $30,000 and $50,000. West of Troost, on the way to State Line Road, neighborhoods are more than 80% white, with incomes more than double those on the east side. There is this separation that started based on skin tone, and it all snowballs, says Chris Good, who grew up east of the divide and now owns Ruby Jean's Juicery on Troost. 5 years ago, after George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer on May 25, 2020, there were hopes that new bridges were starting to be built along this long-standing racial divide. That murder sparked waves of protests in Kansas City and surrounding areas, as it did in cities across the United States. It also prompted residents to re-examine their communities and themselves. In the weeks and months that followed, there were signs of progress many on both sides of Troost believed. Amid a summer of peaceful protests, white patrons would stick their heads into Ellen Neeland's restaurant across the street from Mr. Good's Juicery, just to confirm the restaurant had a black owner before ordering. They were making an effort to show solidarity and wider community support. Buzzy LeCluse, pastor at Pine Ridge Presbyterian Church in North Kansas City, remembers that summer vividly. "I just became committed to talking about how do we not have this happen again," she says. Ms. LeCluse and about two dozen other parishioners on Pine Ridge started reading books on racism and white privilege and then met on Zoom to discuss them during the pandemic. They called themselves the Deep Listening Group. "I grew up in Kansas City, and as a kid, you always heard, 'You don't go out east of Troost,'" says Ms. LeCluse's husband, Joe, a retired administrator of higher education. After the book club took a local library's audio driving tour, which traced the history of Kansas City's policies of systematic segregation, Mr. LeCluse says he's tuned into seeing things I might have passed over before. Such local efforts to see the world differently were part of a larger moment of national reckoning. Juneteenth became a federal holiday. The Mississippi State Legislature removed the Confederate battle flag stars and bars from its state flag, and NASCAR banned it from races. Richmond, Virginia removed Confederate general statues from Monument Avenue, and public schools across the country changed their names. Major production companies such as Paramount, Netflix, and Disney deleted episodes and films that included blackface. Fortune 500 companies launched diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, committees to reflect on organizational practices. And in the nation's capital, a two-block area near the White House was designated Black Lives Matter Plaza, its name painted prominently on the street in giant yellow letters. 5 years after the murder of Mr. Floyd, however, many of those efforts towards recognition and solidarity have dissipated. With the pendulum of public opinion now swinging in the opposite direction, critics of the racial justice movement say it overreached and left the country more racially divided and in more turmoil than before. But the legacy of the past 5 years is complicated. Cities, towns, and streets across America have changed in ways both better and worse in the wake of Mr. Floyd's death. Here in Kansas City, people are grappling with what it all meant. The words Black Lives Matter have been painted prominently on truth right in front of Mr. Good's juicery. 5 years later, the outlines of these words are almost imperceptible. I had this bloody wind at my back when George Floyd was murdered, and it created momentum, he said. But the guilt has worn off. The momentum has gone away. Back to reality we go. Still, even if people have to squint now to make out the progress, that doesn't mean it was all for naught. If the weight of the last few years were honest, says Mr. Good, the only grocery store on Troost wouldn't have empty shelves. But if evil can perpetuate itself, so too can the fight against it. The Troost Wall, of course, didn't happen by accident. Kansas City remains one of the most segregated cities in America because of land use policies implemented in the middle of the 20th century. Racially restrictive neighborhood covenants prohibiting Black or Jewish American buyers, for example, were pioneered in the 1940s by the celebrated local real estate developer J.C. Nichols. Nichols' ideas about subdivisions, zoning, and neighborhood associations would for decades influence other areas of development across the U.S., defining the American suburb. He worked alongside the practice of redlining, which zoned Black residential areas outside those that qualified for federally guaranteed housing loans. Nichols' zoning ideas shaped the emerging communities around Kansas City, and the housing divide today is in many ways coded in the region's underpinnings. It remains a determining factor in many other aspects of Kansas Cityans' lives. What schools children attend, the accessibility of local transportation and healthy food, and the amount of crime and job opportunities. Prairie Village, Kansas, is a bucolic suburb west of State Line Road. It was one of Nichols' crowning achievements. Today, its lack of diversity has been an unspoken issue in an otherwise world-class community, says Mayor Eric Mickelson, who is all too aware of the different reality on the other side of Troost, just a few miles east. And it wasn't because we had racist policies. It was because of our past. But no one wanted to talk about that, he says. The George Floyd summer was the catalyst to talk about that and do things about it. Zoning and housing associations in the 40s kept the streets pristine and the homeowners white. Families buying homes in Prairie Village would have to agree to deed restrictions that mandated hedge heights, set minimum home prices, and prohibited sales to Jewish or Black Americans. These restrictions were affirmed 2 decades prior by the Supreme Court. Although the Supreme Court later ruled in 1948 that racially restrictive covenants couldn't be enforced and didn't remedy the situation, says Richard Rothstein, author of the book The Color of Law. You can trace a lot of the inequality that we still have in this country today to the unconstitutional housing policies that the government created in the 20th century, says Mr. Rothstein. The Kansas City area is an apt example, but those practices were true in every metropolitan area. President Franklin Roosevelt's Federal Housing Administration, for example, a government program to make home ownership more affordable, gave high ratings to mortgage applications for homes with restrictive deeds while refusing to insure redlined Black neighborhoods. And as Prairie Village homes appreciated, these white homeowners built generational wealth. Today, the median price for a Prairie Village home is more than $500,000, according to Realtor.com. So when peaceful protesters weaved through the same neighborhood streets 5 years ago after Mr. Floyd's murder, Mr. Mickelson remembers thinking it was a transformative moment for Prairie Village. Older people watched the march from their front porch. Young children wrote messages of love with sidewalk chalk. It was healing to see so many people come out, says George Williams, a mental health professional and former Prairie Village resident who helped organize the march with local churches. Seeing the nation kind of change, it felt like there was this real openness. In Kansas City, Mr. Good was able to successfully lead an effort to remove Nichols' name from a prominent parkway and local park fountain. The change was part of a growing effort around the country to remove names of those who had contributed to the structural underpinnings of segregated communities from schools, streets, and monuments. Mr. Good also tried to rename Troost, which was named after one of Kansas City's slaveholding founders, to Truth Avenue. That effort has stalled. The two different spellings are T-R-O-O-S-T, which is the name, and T-R-U-T-H is what they wanted and failed to change it to. If the faded Black Lives Matter text on Troost is a quiet metaphor, the recently bulldozed Black Lives Matter Plaza in downtown Washington is a bullhorn. The seeds of the backlash began germinating almost immediately following the protests over Mr. Floyd's death because of the looting and arson that ensued in several cities and the reluctance of many leaders, primarily Democrats, to criticize the rioting in places like Portland, Oregon. That summer also brought calls to defund the police, an idea that was never popular among a majority of Americans. Even in July 2020, during the height of the George Floyd protests, almost three-fourths of Americans, including most Black Americans, didn't think police should be defunded. But a lot of the pushback emerged more gradually from white Americans who came to question the wisdom of society doubling down on questions of racial identity, or who were upset by suggestions that they benefited from a racist system, even if they themselves were struggling to make ends meet. Mr. Williams remembers some church members getting really offended when reading the book White Fragility. Maybe, he wonders, this is why the movement seems to have swung back with a vengeance. Many progressives hit people over the head with it, making others feel guilty did more harm than good. Whereas in the 1960s, it was physical violence. In the 2020s, it was emotional violence through shame and guilt. It made some really strong enemies, says Mr. Williams. People said, I know how bad I feel and I want to protect my kids from this. Where those on the left saw inclusive language as a means of respect for marginalized communities, the right saw a fight about semantics with rigid policing of language that could get even unintentional violators canceled. In June 2020, some 67% of those surveyed told Pew Research Center that they supported the Black Lives Matter movement, but that number fell 16 points by April of 2023. The backlash to George Floyd protests and their impact on many Americans arguably helped Donald Trump retake the presidency in 2024. He campaigned on rolling back DEI efforts in the government, and the day he was inaugurated in January, he signed an executive order doing just that. For many Americans who voted for Mr. Trump in November, progress had become about political correctness that suddenly made everything about race. As one Prairie Village conservative who asked to remain anonymous for fear of retribution from her community told the Monitor, we're getting wokeness out of our schools and out of our military, and it's already out and it's out of our society, said President Trump in his congressional address earlier this year to applause. We don't want it. Wokeness is trouble. Wokeness is bad. Since 2023, some 134 bills have been introduced across the country targeting DEI efforts in education and the workforce, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education, with at least 19 becoming law. Although Missouri has had more than a dozen bills introduced, none has passed, leading the governor to sign an executive order in February eliminating DEI programs in state agencies. Kansas's Democratic governor allowed a 2024 bill to become law without her signature, prohibiting state colleges from requiring students or staff to make any kind of personal statement about DEI. The U.S. Supreme Court has since ended affirmative action in college admissions, meaning that schools can no longer consider race in their acceptances, and a Virginia school board voted to revert back to Confederate general names for two of its schools. Some conservatives on social media have advocated for the president to grant Derek Chauvin a pardon for his 21-year federal sentence for the murder of Mr. Floyd. What I found frustrating is that we'd done all this work, we'd done all this reading, but we still had only two black families in our congregation, says Warren Pierce, a member of the Deep Listening Group and a Ford Motor engineer. When it came time to cross the road, well, what does that mean in action? That's when we ran out of steam. That's where the real challenge lies. In March, jackhammers took to the streets in downtown Washington as demolition began on Black Lives Matter Plaza. Mayor Muriel Bowser attributes the removal to pressure from Republicans in Washington who have threatened the mayor's autonomy amid budget shortfalls and crime. The demolition was supposed to take 6 weeks, but it finished ahead of schedule. The weekend after Mr. Floyd was killed, Todd Harris was walking home at night when a white Prairie Village police officer stopped him and asked him where he's going. This random stop happened within earshot of his own bedroom window. A black man from Minneapolis, where Mr. Floyd was killed, Mr. Harris and his family are one of the few black households who live in Prairie Village, which today is 1% black. He often reminds his children that kids who live less than a mile away live totally different lives. So when Mayor Mickelson asked him to be part of the city's new diversity committee, he said yes. Why people want to live here is obvious, says Mr. Harris, a business owner, but we have a problem. The city looks the same, and that's not indicative of the world we live in. When Mr. Harris and the rest of the diversity committee later reported to the mayor, they had one recommendation at the top of their list: offer more affordable housing options. But the suggestion never got past a list of bullet points. It started a political firestorm, Mr. Mickelson says. Although Johnson County is largely Democratic, it was one of five Kansas counties to vote for then-Vice President Kamala Harris in November. A local conservative group began to protest at city council meetings. The group, which did not respond to repeated requests for comment from the Monitor, passed out flyers. It helped organize 10 petitions to recall Mr. Mickelson. The council did approve some minor changes to allow more residential development in commercial areas, but given how contentious the debate about housing had become, he says there was no appetite to go further with the idea. Mr. Harris resigned from the diversity committee. He was frustrated with the movement, too. He just kept thinking about all of the houses he would drive by with Black Lives Matter yard signs. Now it all just felt like virtue signaling, he says. Everyone is an advocate until it requires them to actually do something. Fast forward to where we are now, nothing's really changed, says Mr. Harris. Their intentions might have been good, but actions speak louder than words. Tony and Chuck Worth, a white couple, fly a Black Lives Matter flag in front of their thrift store, Troost 39, along the Troost Wall. They, too, saw George Floyd's death as a catalyst, a fuel, an opportunity, Mr. Worth says. As that progress stalled, however, he says the racial divides in his city and his country can just feel so overwhelming. They still have friends and family who won't come to visit their business. Since taking over the store almost a decade ago, the Worths have tried to keep the store a place where locals from either side of Truth can come for community, not just for shopping. And on one spring Tuesday afternoon, the Worths' mission seems to have been at least partially realized. Patrons of all different races and ages sifted through clothing racks and checked price tags at the bottom of used appliances. There's free coffee. People linger. One woman shows Ms. Worth her new puppy. I can't change the police department. I can't change City Hall. I can't change the aftermath of redlining, says Mr. Worth. Just do what's in front of you, but don't wait for the other systems. Let's go develop relationships. This sentiment was heard up and down Troost in Prairie Village and across Kansas City. Mr. Neeland, whose pizza restaurant is across the street from Mr. Good's Juicery, still recalls how white patrons tried to support his business 5 years ago. Knowing the area's history of redlining, he named his pizza place The Combine, which for him means to merge or unite. The sign above his bar says, "Exist Together." When a boycott of Target for disbanding its DEI initiatives took off on social media this past March, along with an encouragement to support black-owned businesses, Mr. Neeland's tables were full. Though it had disbanded, the Deep Listening Group still stays in touch through a network called Showing Up for Racial Justice. Wendy Barth, who helped organize the group, says each member has made ripple effects in their own communities. These changes were likely small, she says, but that doesn't mean they were worthless. Ms. Barth researches almost everything she buys, down to her shampoo, to prioritize Black and Latino-owned businesses. Even if that means she can't order off Amazon and has to pay for shipping. It may feel like a small way to move the needle, but it's a small resistance, she says. Mr. Williams is again working with local churches to organize the 5th annual Juneteenth celebration in Prairie Village this summer. Even though he had to move out of Prairie Village recently because he couldn't find affordable housing, he still remembers his first Juneteenth event in 2021. It was the most welcome he'd ever felt in his community. That was the good that I saw. There were people who wanted to learn more, to do more, Mr. Williams says. And I think that spirit has continued in the surrounding community. And even though there has been a swing back, there are still people pushing forward. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Points of Progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it and a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing this point. Number one, Mexico. Captive-bred axolotls, the salamanders with a big smile, can survive in the wild according to a new study. It's an important discovery since they are now found only in Lake Cochimilco, Mexico City. Recognizable by their feathery external gills, between 50 and 1,000 of the critically endangered amphibians are left in the wild. But the study in Mexico City monitored 18 axolotls over 40 days and found that the species can survive in both human-made and restored watersheds. Luis Zambrano, a biologist at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, hopes the study will raise awareness of axolotls as more than just pets. We want to create this link between this animal is a highly popular, this animal is very interesting, but the habitat is going down, Dr. Zambrano said. If we don't do anything, then a habitat will be destroyed in the near future. And that was from the Washington Post. Number two, United States. Adoption of giant batteries for energy storage is surging. Typically, electricity must be used soon after it's generated. But falling prices, better technology, and more favorable regulations are motivating grid operators to adopt storage systems and begin to see how they can increase resilience in the power grid. Between 2021 and 2024, the U.S. increased its battery capacity fivefold, adding 12.3 gigawatts of storage last year. Rising demand for even small rechargeable devices has encouraged innovation, making lithium-ion batteries cheaper and more effective. At least 11 states have procurement targets requiring utilities to meet a certain level of storage capacity. Storage allows for more use of solar and wind energy, systems that produce power only during certain conditions. Last year, when a heat wave caused a surge in electricity demand in Texas, the state's grid operator kept electricity flowing by drawing on batteries. The largest power storage facility in the world opened last year in California. It can store nearly 3.3 gigawatt hours, enough to power 110,000 homes for a day. And that was from Vox. Number 3, European Union. New regulations aim to ban the sale of EU markets of products linked to forced labor. In 2022, the International Labor Organization estimated that some 17.3 million people worldwide are victims of forced labor in the private sector, an 8% increase since 2016. The new regulations, which apply to all companies that conduct business in the EU, allow either national regulators or the European Commission to investigate companies whose supply chains are believed to use forced labor at any point in production. If an investigation finds that products are made with forced labor, the company is given time to address the problem before its products are banned from European markets. A year ago, the EU passed a related regulation that requires large firms to more closely examine their supply chains to prevent human rights abuses, but it excluded 99% of EU-based companies, according to Human Rights Watch. The new law applies in full force to all companies that conduct business in the EU as of mid-December 2027. That was from Human Rights Watch and European Union. Number 4, South Africa. Seeds buried for more than a century can help regenerate their unique ecosystem. In Cape Town's Tokai Park, scientists were surprised that Finbo's seeds, as old as 130 years, could germinate after an accidental fire at a pine plantation. Finbos is a community of plants in a region of more than 6,000 species that are found nowhere else, the greatest concentration of non-tropical higher plant species in the world. The underground seed banks are natural storage areas where the seeds are dormant until triggered by fire. Urbanization and invasive trees, particularly pine, wattle, and eucalyptus brought from Europe in the 1800s, have shrunk Finbos habitats. Scientists say that if remaining pine plantations are cleared and prescribed burns are held, Finbos can be restored with little of the effort and cost associated with vegetation that does not make its own seed banks. And that was from The Conversation. And last but not least, number 5, Indonesia. Two new systems address deforestation in Indonesia from the ground up. Monitoring that relies on satellite images doesn't always indicate whether a tree loss is due to illegal activity. Instead, the platform, groundtruth.id, equips indigenous people and local communities with a tool to anonymously report violations, supplemented by geolocation data. Kaom Telepak, the nonprofit behind the initiative, verifies and publishes the reports, helping authorities to act quickly and prevent long-term environmental damage. An online dashboard in development will verify where commodities come from before they're exported. At the end of this year, the European Union will require that imports of 7 commodities and some derived products come from places that were not deforested or degraded. Indonesia is a major exporter of 5 of the commodities: palm oil, timber, coffee, cocoa, and rubber. Indonesia shares with Papua New Guinea the largest rainforest in Asia and the 3rd largest in the world. And that was from Mangabe. And all that was compiled by Cameron Poo and Troy Aiden Sambanjan, who are staff writers. And now for Science and Nature in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and here it is. It's entitled, "There's One Rare Earth Mine in the U.S. How That Might Change Soon." This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's a staff writer. And there is that paragraph entitled, "Why We Wrote This." Chinese restrictions on exports of rare earth minerals, which have critical military and commercial uses, are spurring calls for increased U.S. production. Reestablishing that domestic supply chain has strategic importance and ecological risks. On an arid swath of the Mojave Desert on the California side of the border with Nevada, sits the only facility in America that mines rare earth minerals, materials policymakers across the political spectrum agree are necessary for the economy and national defense. The mine is called Mountain Pass. The minerals hold a group of elements near the bottom of the periodic table called lanthanides, which are used in everything from drones to missiles to electric vehicles and laptop screens. And both the facility and the bits of earth it extracts are getting a lot of attention. That's because China, which controls 60% of the world's rare earth element extraction and almost all its processing, has put new restrictions on the export of many of these metals. The 90-day pause in the trade war between the United States and China, announced May 12th, is likely to include an easing of those restrictions. But analysts don't expect them to be eliminated entirely. That uncertainty has rattled economists, manufacturers, and security experts. Rare earths, along with other critical minerals, have been called the new oil, the geological necessities of modern economies and warfare. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. gets around 70% of its rare earth imports from China. It's difficult to imagine any manufacturing or industrial supply chain that doesn't, in one way, shape, or form, depend on these materials, says Matt Schlesser, Chief Communications Officer at MP Materials, the company that reopened the 70-year-old Mountain Pass mine in 2017. There is a consensus that we need to have capacity here. But shifting the rare element supply chain back to the U.S. is complicated, despite the fact that a bipartisan array of lawmakers has been worried about this issue for years. The industry moved to China in the 1990s to benefit from lower costs, lax labor laws, and non-existent environmental protections, according to many analysts. Re-establishing a domestic process means that companies will have to figure out how to make cleaner extractive energy, or the government will have to reduce environmental and permitting regulations. In March, President Donald Trump issued an executive order to speed up mineral mining projects by expediting the permitting process, and he also directed agencies to sunset environmental regulations that could impact energy projects. For its part, MP Materials boasts of its sustainability record. Mr. Schlesser says that environmental analysis of Mountain Pass demonstrate a far cleaner production process than what happens at Chinese mines. It is now the second largest rare earth mine in the world. It has plans to open a battery facility in Texas to process the metals, and says General Motors has agreed to purchase auto components there. But the vast majority of its minerals are still exported for processing. And while there are multiple U.S. companies working to develop cleaner, next-generation rare earth technology, analysts believe it will still be years before they are able to contribute substantially to the U.S. supply chain. A priority for Biden and Trump. Both the Biden and Trump administrations have earmarked money to try to secure American access to rare earth elements. In his first term, President Trump worked to speed permitting and release Defense Production Act spending for rare earth mining. President Joe Biden sent billions of dollars through his two massive spending bills, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, to secure battery supply chains. He also directed Defense Production Act spending to secure the minerals. Since 2020, the Department of Defense has allocated more than $439 million to build what it calls a domestic mine-to-magnet supply chain. Rare earths are used in military equipment from sonars to fighter jets, radars to submarines. They are in precision weapons, flight control systems, and more. The U.S. military is existentially dependent on them, says Bud Barstow, a Cornell University biological engineer who works in next-generation rare earth technology. President Trump issued an executive order April 15th directing the Department of Commerce to investigate the rare earth elements supply chain. The president's comments about taking control of Greenland, many analysts say, have a lot to do with the rare earth mining potential. Drawbacks and potential solutions. Part of the complication in mining rare earth elements comes from the fact that they aren't actually rare at all. To the contrary, they are abundant in Earth's crust, but they tend to be dispersed widely rather than found in concentrated deposits and are extremely difficult to separate. To extract them, most companies use large, open-pit mines, which environmentalists say are ecologically damaging. Processing them has traditionally required toxic, highly corrosive substances that can leach into waterways and soil. Rare earth concentrations also tend to happen alongside uranium, a geophysical reality that has led to radiation concerns at many mines, says Raquel Dominguez, circular economy policy advocate at the environmental group Earthworks. Extracting them is often extremely dangerous, she notes. The U.S. was largely self-sufficient when it came to rare earth minerals until the 1990s. And when companies moved to China, Dr. Barstow says, many in the industry figured that it would be easy to reshore the process when they wanted. But time went on and the industry remained in China. Dr. Barstow grew interested in rare earth elements in 2011 during the Obama administration when the Chinese government first reduced its exports of the elements. I think the reason they did it was to show that they could, he says. I remember thinking that maybe biology could do something to help. With a team of scholars, he began investigating biomining, or using genetically adapted microorganisms to dissolve minerals, separate metals, and replace the traditional toxic processing of rare earths. The process worked. One of his postgraduate students has since commercialized the approach to rare earth elements. Dr. Barstow received a National Science Foundation grant last year to create a catalog of microorganisms and genes and how they interact with minerals. Other startups around the U.S. are also focused on finding new ways to process rare earth elements in a more ecologically friendly manner, which often with synthetic biology. Rare earth mining and green energy. For its part, MP Minerals touts its sustainability measures, like water recycling and secure waste storage, and points out that the mine meets stringent California environmental regulations. Some environmentalists, including Ms. Dominguez, are skeptical about how green any extractive industry can be. A mine's impact on the surrounding ecology and people can be severe, and in the U.S., disproportionately so far indigenous people, she says, or so for indigenous people, she says. Rather than trying to use technology to green a dirty industry, Americans should rethink consumption patterns, she suggests. Yet even in the environmental world, there are many supporters of rare earth mining, in large part because the minerals are essential for decarbonization. They're used in everything from solar panels to energy storage batteries to EVs. Without rare earth minerals, there is no green energy. Mining is an underappreciated factor in the clean energy transition, says Gernot Wagner, climate economist at Columbia University's Business School. They got a bullet here. It says questions, comments, email the science team at sci@csmonitor.com. And now we find ourselves in the home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and I will read it. It is entitled, A Storybook Ending for My Traveling Companions. After a lifetime on the road, my books find a new place in the world. This is written by Jack Barlow. A few months ago, a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf was installed in the spare room of my cozy home in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Putting up a bookshelf is usually neither here nor there, but this one marked an occasion worth celebrating. It was the first time in a lifetime of globetrotting that all my books have had a home. This is no small feat. An inveterate reader, I've left a trail of books in my wake as I've bounced around the globe, house to house in my native New Zealand, back and forth to the United States, with side trips everywhere in between, from bustling Hanoi, Vietnam, to cosmopolitan Brussels. At its absurd peak, I had books lying in six different places across three continents. My friends and family who tended to house these errant books generally handled the influx with a mix of good-natured exasperation and resignation. The bulk of the collection has always been in New Zealand. In mid-2021, after a solid decade of navigating the labyrinthine American visa system, My wife and I moved to the United States. The shift was initially intended to be permanent, which meant all our possessions would come too. Many of those possessions, unsurprisingly, were literary. Getting everything out of the country happened in several parts. First, we crammed our Subaru Legacy station wagon to the brim and headed through the winding roads and wide plains of the South Island. My wife squeezed in a passenger seat as books and the occasional record slipped through to keep her company. For the final leg from Auckland to Baton Rouge, the moving company packed our boxes. As a pair of burly movers carefully wrapped our possessions, my wife asked if they often sent such large shipments stateside. "Oh, yeah, sometimes," one of them said. He paused. "Not usually this many books, though, eh?" After my books had been boxed up for 3 years during various moves and travel, finally getting to unpack them in Baton Rouge felt like meeting old friends. "Welcome to America," I would say, holding a rediscovered treasure up to the light. Books can feel like companions, and gazing at them lined up together on my new shelf has brought back memories of when they were bought and what I was doing when I stumbled across them, and the adventures they've been dragged on. Sometimes it's like gazing at an alternative narrative, in literary form, of the journey that brought me here. Much of my new bookshelf is taken up by books about the United States or by its authors. This is partly the result of a lifelong fascination with the country, and partly an immigrant's attempt to better understand his new home, with all of its quirks and messy contradictions. Toward the top is a battered copy of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, a book that fed wide-eyed dreams of America as I hungrily devoured it on the park benches and in cheap youth hostels throughout Australia. On the second shelf is a similarly dog-eared oral biography of Hunter S. Thompson that I bought on my first stateside trip in 2009. My first few months in the country were spent on the road as a touring guitar player. Gazing at the book now brings back memories, and reading it in a recreational vehicle between shows, the vast western landscape of California and Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming passing by as we drove. Later on that same trip, I visited Louisiana for the first time and fell in love with its extroverted friendliness, its music, and its swampy, colorful culture. Pride of place on one shelf is T. Harry Williams' masterful Huey Long biography, which I bought at a book sale as a university undergraduate in New Zealand. Revisited after my first U.S. trip, finally started reading in a cafe in Laos, and finished on a Cambodian beach. Books sometimes have their own circuitous lives, too. Scattered on the shelves are adventure books from my childhood, with the daring adventurer Biggles from the eponymous British series embarrassingly well represented. Filling the gaps is a mishmash of biographies, fiction of all sorts, and tomes on music, sports, and politics. This isn't to say I've read them all. I'd love to dive into David McCullough's 1,100-page Harry Truman biography, but what about Isaac Deutscher's equally gargantuan The Prophet? Or anything by the many writers I have yet to read, like Thomas Pynchon, say, or Maya Angelou, or Richard Wright, or Doris Kearns Goodwin. Readers know all about the pressure, a pressure that can feel almost accusatory, that can come with owning a stack of unread books. Plenty has been written about it, with the likes of legendary Italian writer Umberto Eco and Lebanese-American scholar and essayist Nassim Nicholas Taleb weighing in. Writing about Dr. Eco's famously large personal library in his book, The Black Swan, The Impact of a Highly Improbable, Dr. Taleb writes, "The more you know, the larger the row of unread books." In many ways, our move to the United States was a dream come true. Yet circumstances and dreams change. What was supposed to be permanent now appears temporary, with a move back to the antipodes all but certain at some point. One day the shelves will be emptied, the books placed back in their boxes, ready for another journey. Looking at the bookshelf serves as a reminder of what's been and hints at what's to come. For all of life's impermanence and uncertainty, one thing is for sure. Wherever my wife and I go next, a good book will be along for the ride. And finally, we find ourselves in the Monitor's View section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them, and I got plenty of time to read them both. The first one is entitled, "The Meekness Behind Flourishing." Societies the world over have long sought to define and measure what constitutes a good life, a life of meaning as well as of means. Just published data from an expansive Global Flourishing Study, or GFS, is contributing new insights into this topic. The first-round surveys in a five-year project covered more than 200,000 participants. One finding drawing widespread concern is that young people are reporting lower levels of well-being and not doing as well as they used to. Yet perhaps the biggest finding across age cohorts in 22 countries shows that poorer nations outrank far wealthier ones in flourishing. The United States and Sweden hovered near the middle of the index. The United Kingdom and Turkey were at the lower end. Japan was at the very bottom. Meanwhile, Indonesia, the Philippines, Mexico, Egypt, Kenya, Brazil, and Nigeria scored in the top 10. None of these countries boasts high per capita incomes or substantive social safety nets, but they do share one characteristic: regular attendance at religious services and feeling loved or cared for by God or a spiritual force. With economic development and secularization, we have sometimes been neglecting or even suppressing powerful spiritual pathways to flourishing. The study's report asks, noting that richer countries demonstrated an inverse or negative relationship between meaningful living and gross domestic product. Although the study did not ascribe a causal link between religious worship and individual well-being, the association between them is consistent with other research. Spearheaded by Harvard and Baylor universities in partnership with Gallup, the CFS delved into six dimensions: happiness and life satisfaction, mental and physical health, meaning and purpose, character and virtue, close social relationships, and financial and material stability. Those who attend religious services weekly scored higher in all areas. This finding held true even in very secular countries, study collaborators said. Envisioning flourishing as a process of growth rather than a static condition, GFS researchers said, will require considering spiritual dynamics in addition to parameters such as age and economics. For Baylor religion professor Paul Marshall, it goes almost without saying that money is not making people flourish more. Instead, purpose, community, relationships, and religion count more than wealth and success, he said. A growing recognition of this may have prompted the GFS author's suggestion that we, humanity, may need a reconsideration of spiritual pathways to well-being. And the second and last Monitor's View article is entitled, "The Inviting Geniality of a Porch." A recent survey of young Americans showed 85% say their generation spends too much time online. Another poll last year found 60% of all U.S. adults say the nation's top problem is the inability of Democrats and Republicans to work together. So just where can people go to meet face-to-face, perhaps to work out differences, even enjoy each other's company? One answer may lie in a special exhibit running until November 23rd in Venice, Italy. The exhibit called Porch, An Architecture of Generosity, is the United States' entry at the 19th International Architecture Biennale. The entries, 54 works in all, showcase interpretations of the front porch in American life. The idea is to really help people understand what the value of being together is. Susan Chen, an organizer of the U.S. Pavilion at what is known as one of the world's largest exhibitions, told the New York Times. And nothing speaks to neighborliness that more than the welcoming space at the front of a house that is both public and private, indoors and out. With a few rockers or a swinging chair, the perch is an invitation for dialogue. Such spaces, which can include the urban stoop, are a way for people to slow down and reflect together, Ms. Chen told the website Design Boom. In recent decades, the number of new houses designed with a front porch has increased after a long decline. That signals a yearning for local connection, and in addition, dozens of communities now hold annual festivals during which musicians play from people's porches. The first such porch fest began in 2007 in Ithaca, New York, and has since spread across the country as well as to Canada and Australia. In mid-19th century America, the French observer Alexis de Tocqueville marveled at the ability of people to solve problems by forming new associations. If it is a question of bringing to light a truth or developing a sentiment with the support of a great example, they associate, he wrote. The front porch, an architectural feature brought to America by enslaved people from Africa, is today on the front line of restoring the art of listening. Or as Peter McKeith, another organizer of the U.S. exhibit, put it, the porch is a space generous in spirit, grounded in place, and open to the world. Well, we got about a minute or so left, so I'll read some statistics from the numbers in the news column. 1,000, that's the amount of dollars that U.S. President Donald Trump's administration is offering unauthorized immigrants to voluntarily leave the country. According to the Department of Homeland Security, it costs over $17,000 to arrest and deport a migrant. 46, that's the percentage of U.S. adults who express support for Israel in a survey conducted in March, the lowest measure in 25 years. At the same time, 33% of U.S. adults who now say they sympathize with Palestinians is up 6 percentage points from last year. 70, that's the percentage of U.S. Catholics who think same-sex marriage should be allowed, according to a 2023 through 2024 survey. LGBTQ+ believers and their allies hope newly elected Pope Leo XIV will support increased LGBTQ+ acceptance in the church. And briefly here, 46, that's the percentage drop in vehicle registrations of new Teslas in Germany compared with last year. Demand in Sweden, France, and Britain also fell, despite total gains for electric cars. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.